Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about some friends today.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of friends, we're going to talk about The Inklings, which is a book by Humphrey Carpenter about C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien, Owen Barfield, Charles Williams.
Hugo Dyson,
yeah. All these folks who used to gather and call themselves the Inklings in Oxford, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or at Oxford College, right? So this is episode 166 of the Good Story Podcast.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I chose this book. This is the second time I've read it. And it had been long enough ago that I didn't remember that it was mostly about C.S. Lewis. So C.S. Lewis was the center of this group. And I think that was the explanation in the front. He said, I'm going to spend by far the most time with Lewis because he was sort of the eye of that storm, right?
That, and he said he'd already done Tolkien's biography. Mm-hmm. So he'd kind of said everything about him specifically that he needed to say there.
Right.
And Lewis needed more of his life told.
That is right. He did say that. And I think I want to read that book.
I was thinking the same thing. I've never really been that interested because I know enough of it to kind of go, oh, yeah, I get it. But after reading this, it was so well written, very enjoyable. So it made me interested.
Me too. I was intrigued with Tolkien even more than before on this. I think he's the one I identified with most.
Yes.
He just felt like really my kind of guy.
Right.
You know, I liked it. It was interesting. You know, he had four kids, you know, a wife and four kids at home. And Lewis had a very interesting circumstances in his life. You know, it was kind of like in three stages, I guess, as an adult. But two of the circumstances were not typical.
Right.
But and then a lot of their conversations, you know, I just naturally sort of fell in with Tolkien. I think mm-hmm. I would have really enjoyed talking to him. Not that I wouldn't have enjoyed Lewis as well. I would have, but Lewis seemed, you know, a little, I guess, demanding of his friends. You know, it's like, you know, you have to meet this bar before you can, you know, we're going to talk at any length. That's the way I felt he was that kind of a guy.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. He, one passage I was reading that I had marked said that, you know, he had been trained in logic from a fairly young age by a tutor he had. And that's what makes his later books so great, is he's keeping them very human feeling usually, but they're intensely logical. But he also demanded that anyone who was going to talk to him also have the passion of interest in the subject they were talking about. They had to have feeling as well as logic.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had to be all in.
You had to be all in, right. And that that tutor was an atheist.
Right.
And that was super interesting. It just in the very beginning. I mean, we're talking about within the first few pages.
Mm-hmm.
So Lewis's mother had passed away. And he went to this school. It was called I just marked it down because I thought it was interesting. The Wynyard School in Hertfordshire. And him and his brother Warney, C.S. Lewis and his brother Warney, went to this school. And this sentence, it says, by the time the school finally collapsed and the headmaster was certified mad, Warney had already moved on to Malvern College. And I was just like, what?
Certified
mad?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And then it said it was a terrible introduction to the outer world.
Yes.
And its only good result was to drive the two brothers closer together for mutual protection. Isn't that something?
I know. Well, yeah. And the other thing is that that starts to show you it did drive the brothers together, and they had a bond that was never broken until Lewis's death.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I did love how close they were.
Right. I remember a movie. It was about the later stages of Lewis's life, wasn't it?
Shadowland.
Yeah, that must have been it. But I remember him and his brother sitting in a room, and they each had a desk in that room, and it was in their house, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar to you?
I didn't see that
image was in my head. But it was like, you know, yeah, he's got a desk in a room, you know, he's surrounded by books, and then just to his left is another desk, and there's his brother, you know.
And, that must be, yeah.
Yeah.
It must be accurate, although from the book, I got the image continually of his Oxford rooms with his brother coming in and using his desk when he wasn't there.
Yeah, but I believe, unless I'm mistaken, I think that the brother moved in with them.
Oh, yeah.
He moved in with them when he was staying with this older woman, right? And I forgot her name, but I have it written down. But anyway, kind of in this first stage of life, it was like almost like a surrogate mother. Kind of that he latched onto.
Let's hope that's all it was.
Right, right. You know, there are questions. Yeah. But he ended up basically living with them, and his brother moved in with them, right?
Right.
And then he moved to college, Malvern, which was at Oxford, I think. Or I can't remember the name. Magdalen, I thought.
Yeah.
And then he had rooms there, and I don't think his brother lived with him there. But then later on when he married the younger woman,
Joy Davidson.
Joy, right. And I think he moved in with them. Maybe I'm incorrect on that.
No, he did because okay. He would talk about something about how he felt about living there now. You know.
Right.
Not in a bad way, just going, weird. It was like this, you know.
Right. So that's what I meant by, you know, his life was a little atypical.
Just a touch.
It's a touch atypical.
But the thing was, is in those stages of life, even when everybody's like, so what's the deal with him and Mrs. Moore? Because of the uncertainty and his extreme privacy on all those levels, you're kind of just left to admire his devotion.
Mm.
You know, this lady got old and querulous, and he stuck with her to the end, you know.
Yeah, sure
and
did.
They said some of it was duty, but also some of it was he was just very good-natured also and let a lot of things slip off of him.
Right, right.
Or seemed to.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And another thing that I marked, you know, while we're still in this early period of his life, which, well, we just talked about his later, but if we're back to his earlier, this atheist headmaster. So what happened is that school collapsed and his headmaster went mad. And then his dad sent him to his dad's old headmaster, and he just had a few students. He didn't have a school.
Right.
He was just this guy, and his name was W.T. Kirkpatrick. And he was an atheist. And I really loved, it says, W.T. Kirkpatrick, tall and muscularly lean, was a strict atheist who nevertheless put on his best suit to dig the garden on Sunday. This, however, was his only recorded piece of illogical behavior. So, yeah, I love how this
Sunday
is
Sunday I should dress up. I'm going to do some gardening.
That's right. It says he was fearsome in conversation, for no sentence passed his lips that was not ruthlessly logical. And then when Jack Lewis first met his new teacher on arrival at the railway station, the boy attempted some small talk, remarking that the Surrey countryside was more wild than he had expected. "Stop!" shouted Kirkpatrick. "What do you mean by wildness? And what grounds had you for not expecting it?" So... yeah.
Yeah.
There's your formation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was something, you know. And it's also interesting, too. He naturally, as a student, sort of molded his beliefs based on this teacher and was really an atheist himself at this point in his life. Let's see. It says... Lewis says, you know, I think I believe in no religion. There's absolutely no proof for any of them. And from a philosophical standpoint, Christianity is not even the best. All religions, that is, all mythologies, to give them their proper name, are merely man's own invention, Christ as much as loci. And Lewis offered his own interpretation of Christianity. After the death of a Hebrew prophet, Yeshua, whose name we have corrupted into Jesus... He became regarded as a god. A cult sprang up, which was afterwards connected with the ancient Hebrew Yahweh worship. And so Christianity came into being, one mythology among many. And I felt that was important to point out because of what's going to happen later, some conversations that are later. So it is interesting, and I find this in a lot of friends myself that are atheists or agnostics, is there seems to be this God-shaped hole, you know, which is the way mm-hmm. I've heard it said, that keeps them coming back. You know, they want to talk about it a lot.
Right. They don't just go, it's stupid, and move on, which is what my parents did. Mm-hmm. They're like, why talk about it? It's not real.
Yeah.
And then they just ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
Most people is they keep wanting to argue with you about it. So, you know, if you really didn't care, then you don't talk about it at all. You just forget about it. But on some level, you're kind of interested. And Lewis was always in love with stories and with mythology, specifically Northern mythology. Once he found the Norse myths and the, you know, I guess Germanic myths, he just loved stories about Balder and all that kind of thing. And one of the threads throughout this that was so interesting, or just reinforced also to me, was that God draws you to him based on your loves, because he knows you so well already. And of course he made you, but he used story and Northern mythos and mythology to lead C.S. Lewis to a point where he could listen to what everybody was talking about. So because of that, because Lewis didn't even like J.R.R. Tolkien. They both were kind of like, what a weirdo of the other one, you know,
yeah.
Kind of cold, kind of strange, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so then, but because Tolkien was trying to, he was trying to keep the classics and old things taught at the school when they wanted to be dumped. And so he started this Icelandic language club where they were reading all the old myths in the original language. And so Lewis was like, oh, that sounds interesting, even though this weirdo is doing it. And so that's where they got to know each other better and enjoy it. And he really could admire Tolkien's command of the language and the way he translated things. And then because they became friends and they started getting together with like-minded people who also loved this stuff, and his logic, and they were all understood how to argue logically and passionately, which he admired, he was able to be put in a position where he could listen more as different ideas came up that led him to being unable to deny God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was especially impressed with Owen Barfield, who people don't really know much about, and including me, but he had done a piece about language. And this was this short book about mythology, saying that speakers didn't make a distinction between the literal and the metaphorical, but used words in what might be called a mythological manner. It says early users of language wouldn't have made a distinction between any of the different meanings of, like, the Latin spiritus, which would be spirit, breath, wind. Mm-hmm. To them, it would have been the whole thing at once. It was reality as well as concept. And that influenced Tolkien and Lewis and led to several other conversations that changed everything. And so this book is kind of genius at showing not only Lewis's path, but the path that friendships and, discussion and taking things seriously can make in your life. It just makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's just one of those, you know, in a way, without Barfield and Tolkien, you know, we wouldn't have had Lewis.
And Dyson.
And Dyson. Yeah, sure.
Who was there that night. Yeah.
So it's just, it is amazing, you know, how people affect each other. Right.
Because without Lewis, we wouldn't have had the Lord of the Rings, which, because he kept pushing Tolkien to, no, you haven't worked on this for a year. I want more. Pick it up and finish it.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. And Lewis really did like the Lord of the Rings. That was, that was nice, you know, and, it wasn't always reciprocated. That was an interesting thing too.
Right.
Tolkien was not a fan of Narnia.
So again, I'm in line with Tolkien.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, that was interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that I wrote down, let's see, that group that Tolkien put together was called the Coal Biters.
That's it. I loved that.
Yeah. And, the Icelandic name was Kolbitar, Kolbitar, a jesting term meaning men who lounge so close to the fire in winter that they bite the coal.
Yes.
Yeah. And so this was in 1926. And they, you know, Tolkien formed this club to read Icelandic sagas and myths. And it's like, all right, everybody come and let's drink beer and do this. And people showed up. And then I really liked this line. On 3 December 1929, Lewis wrote to Arthur Greaves, "One week, I was up till 2:30 on Monday talking to the Anglo-Saxon professor Tolkien, who came back with me to college from a society, and sat discoursing of gods and giants of Asgard for 3 hours, then departing in the wind and the rain. Who could turn him out? For the fire was bright and the talk good." I like that a lot.
It sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And that's sort of the, the ideal view I have of the Inklings, you know, is mm-hmm. at their very best moments, right?
Yeah.
At their very best moments, it was this way. And things always change, you know, and in my own life, it makes me think of my own life, you know, where I've had, you know, peak moments where you have this group of people. I can think of two or three in my life, you know, and I'm talking about, you know, you're one of this group, by the way, you know, the group that I'm currently in, you know what I mean?
Well, same here. So,
yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. So but you have these groups in your life that come and go, you know, there's like this little waves, you know, of things that happen and there's like these little perfect gems of time. And that's how I view the Inklings anyway, even though it was not always that way. It was not always that way. But to do what they did is something that is extremely appealing to me. Getting together to read and do that, to talk about your writings and things like that on a regular basis, that's just time well spent.
Yeah, and it was an unusual group because they were all such distinctive individuals, but they were all like-minded about a lot of things. And in a way, it's kind of interesting that Lewis was one of them because most of them were pretty faithful in their religion. And he kept being surprised by it and going, oh, I really admired this guy. And then I found out he's a Christian. What is up with this? I thought, you know, only idiots are Christians. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, he was very modern. That's an attitude you find now where, you know, our friend Jesse from SFF Audio a few times has introduced me to groups that we'll be discussing a book with where I might not know them. And he'll go, she's Catholic, but it's okay. She knows how to use her brain. And it's that same thing. It's like I'm hearing C.S. Lewis talk in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? That's absolutely true. Yeah.
And then he turned into one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so the Inklings was interesting because I had always thought they only met on, I guess it was Tuesday mornings at the bar. What was the Eagle and Child?
Yeah, Eagle and Child, yeah.
And then it turns out they also would meet on Thursday evenings in Tolkien's Oxford rooms.
Or Lewis's, yeah.
I'm sorry, I was thinking Lewis. Yeah, Lewis's rooms where they would just kind of drift in. Whoever was available would drift in.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was like two completely different venues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, someday I'll have a drink in the Eagle and Child. That would be fun. I'm sure that lots of people go do that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have another note here with Barfield. Now, we talked a little bit about Owen Barfield. One of the first things that Lewis and Barfield used to do was go take long walks.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1929, they made a 4-day journey from Salisbury to Lyme Regis. Right. It's just like, yeah, I'm going to go walk somewhere for 4 days.
That's a real English thing. Or maybe mean thing to do.
It's a very hobbit thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah. And it kind of goes along with, I don't know if you've read the space trilogy that
No, Lewis, I have not read that, but this book makes me want to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the very first book he wrote starts off with the main character on one of those long walks all by himself. And, you know, kind of like, well, if I get, hopefully I can find somewhere to spend the night.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Just in his knapsack and his stick.
Yeah, that's funny that you say that, because the next part it says, they did not attempt to cover vast distances each day in the matter of fanatical hikers. Lewis said he disliked the word hiking because it was unnecessarily self-conscious for something so simple as going for a walk.
Yeah.
But they certainly set a good pace and would reckon to do perhaps 20 miles a day. Maybe a little more on easy country, or rather less if the going was rough. And then this was interesting. Lewis refused to allow the party to take packed meals, insisting on plenty of stops at pubs.
I love that.
Me too.
I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Also, yeah. I liked that Tolkien went with him a few times, but they're like, no, he's no good. He's too slow. He keeps wanting to stop and look at the plants. He's
That's sit exactly down and rest. Right. I was going to say the same thing. So somewhere I marked that too, where he's, they're like, you know, they're wanting to do 20 miles a day. And he's like, you know, look at this tree. Isn't this amazing?
He's more like a hobbit. Yeah.
That was funny stuff.
Yeah, I thought that was great.
He and his friends always made a mid-morning halt for beer or draft cider. And there was more beer at lunchtime as an accompaniment to bread and cheese. You know, this is just reminds me of hobbits. So, very cool. Very cool stuff.
And also, these days, who thinks of doing something like that just for enjoyment? Because you have no other distraction. You're walking, even at a quick pace, it's still fairly slow. It takes effort. It's only conversation for entertainment or silence if you're just not talking. And so that's something that seems almost foreign because you're not trying to achieve a goal. You know, he won't let you say, well, we'll make it here, we'll make it there. You just see where you go.
Yeah.
It's very foreign sounding when I think about it. Nice sounding.
Yeah, I mean, sounds very nice to me.
Yeah.
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 Something I ought to do more often.
I know, but you know, America is not set up for that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, you'd say it perfectly, because in my previous town, I took to walking to work one time. I thought, you know, I should walk to work. It took me about a half an hour to do that.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, constantly people would stop and say, you need a ride? Yeah. Like, no, I'm doing this on purpose. Thank you. You know, yeah. It was just so odd to everybody. To be doing that, you know, they constantly stopped and asked if I needed a ride, you know. But yeah, you're right. It is foreign. We're not set up that way. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
You have to go on a European vacation in order to take your walking trip.
That's right. We'll go walk the Camino.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
That would be like the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be fun? You
it
and your wife,
fun.
Me and Tom, would just do the Camino together?
Yeah, I'd love that.
Super slow.
Sign me up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No need to hurry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you talked about Lewis and Barfield, okay? Barfield and the mythology. So you just mentioned that. So I'm just flipping through the book. And I, you know, going through my notes as I go. But this is the first time that the book mentions Lewis and Barfield and philosophy and them having a philosophical discussion. So this was the first step that Lewis took as all these Christians keep talking to him, right?
Right.
I don't know what if you have a hard copy or not. I'm page 36, but on mine. It says here, Lewis and Barfield were at this time engaged in a battle of ideas. So Barfield had for several years been a disciple of Rudolf Steiner's anthroposophy, a form of religious philosophy which teaches or which offers a very idiosyncratic account of the nature of the world and the relationship between God and man. Lewis was at first alarmed at his friend's enthusiasm for Steiner's teachings with the occasional use of the word occult and their inclusion of such doctrines as a belief in reincarnation. So I'm not sure about that. Okay. But where I wanted to get to, let's see. He declared to Barfield, this is Lewis, imaginative vision cannot be involved as a source of certainty for any one judgment against another. In other words, it was splendid to have sensations of delight when you saw a sunset or read a poem, but this told you nothing objective about the world. The imaginative must be kept strictly apart from the rational. But Barfield disagreed with that. Besides following Steiner's teachings, he had for many years admired and studied Coleridge's writings on the imagination, and he began to argue this point with Lewis, both on walking tours and in correspondence that they soon named the Great War.
I love that.
Yeah. In particular, Barfield tried to persuade Lewis that purely rational argument of the kind that he had used since he was tutored by Kirkpatrick often depended on artificial terms and had little to do with the actual business of life. Barfield also did his best to convince Lewis that imagination and aesthetic experience did lead, if not automatically to objective truth, then at least to a better understanding of the world. Lewis did not accept all Barfield's points, but as a result of the Great War, he ceased to separate his emotional experiences from his intellectual process and came to regard joy and poetic vision in their way as truthful as rational argument and objective fact. So that was step one. Placed on by this author. Yeah.
And it's interesting because when you're talking to somebody who's not a believer, and I wasn't for so much of my life, so I totally get this, but they're wanting to prove things. They're wanting it very objective and very logical. And when you do that, we are not solely objective and logical creatures, and you have to allow room for all of us to experience the truth. Mm-hmm. The totality of truth. And so it's a tricky thing because you don't want one to overbalance the other, but you have to allow both in.
Right.
I mean, that's just how we are.
Yeah, that's just how we are. Right.
And neither one is totally objective because you're applying logic to something that might not really be logical.
Mm-hmm.
Like nature.
Yeah, something that's going on in nature. Where we assume that this is all there is, you know, when you're doing a rational universe and all this, and this is all there is this logical argument, you're assuming that you know everything that is.
Right.
Right. There is nothing outside this. There is nothing supernatural. There's, you know, and all that. But still, you know, it's possible. And to deny that possibility is not rational, I don't believe.
Well, it occurs to me to set yourself up as the arbiter of what is and what is not, because I cannot see it or whatever, is illogical.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see an atom, but I can believe the proofs for it.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you're setting yourself up like that, you're letting people hold God back to a level of proof that you would not even accept for an atom. I mean, you'll accept much more for quarks and black holes and black matter and all this stuff that we can't even see and the regular person cannot understand on the level a scientist can.
Yeah.
But you won't let anybody talk with you about God that way because you know everything.
True.
I mean, I'm just saying, yeah. And I was one of those people. I mean, mm-hmm. If somebody was arguing with me, I was like, well, prove it. And I did that to God, who did graciously go, sure enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
visible
so
and
there's
invisible,
no such
right?
thing as pure logic like that, huh?
Yeah, visible and invisible.
Right.
Says the
Creed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sorry, I had jumped the gun when I earlier was talking about language and Barfield's.
No, that's we're getting right to it.
Yeah.
No, I mean it was a good intro. So, then the next thing that I have marked is by the beginning of September 1931. 11 years had passed since Jack Lewis had stopped being a dogmatic atheist. So, it says, long as ago as 1920, his study of philosophy had led him to postulate some sort of God as the least objectionable theory, though he added, of course, we know nothing, right?
Right.
The notion of an ultimate truth made sense to him because, as he remarked in 1924, when commenting on Bertrand Russell's free-thinking idealism, our ideas are, after all, a natural product, which is there's Barfield's influence,
uh-huh.
And there must be some objective standard, some ultimate fact to explain them. On the other hand, God seemed a crude and nursery-like word, and for several years Lewis used other terms to describe his notion of fundamental truth. During this time, he was, like most of those who studied philosophy at Oxford in the early 1920s, still accepting the work of Hegel and his disciples, and as a result, he chose Hegelian expressions such as the absolute mind, all caps, not all caps, capitalize absolute, capitalize mind, or right. just the absolute, capital A. So he had talked himself into the concept of God and the concept of ultimate truth. And I've had that conversation with a lot of people before, mm-hmm. too, where, you know, sometimes you can't even get him to admit that there is such a thing as truth. And and sometimes that's hard to argue. And it's like, man, you know, I don't know how you even function in day-to-day yeah. life. But, you know, it's like in your day-to-day life, you do not believe what you are arguing with me about.
Exactly.
Because you can't. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, you go through life expecting certain things to be true. When I sit down on this chair, it's going to hold me up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And not only that, it does. It keeps doing it. Mm-hmm. It keeps doing it. Yeah, so so he's talked himself into that, right, with Barfield's assistance. Mm-hmm. That's as far as he's gotten right here in 1931, it says, you know. We're getting really close to this conversation now.
Oh, yes, but I can't wait for.
Yeah, and then this is really good stuff. So this is, a typical Inklings night, I would say, where mm-hmm. you've got Tolkien and Lewis and I believe Dyson and Barfield.
And yes. they're together. No, not Barfield. Which are you on, like, page 42?
I'm on page 40, actually.
It's just Tolkien and Dyson at that famous dinner.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
I might be a little ahead of you then.
Okay. So let's see here. I had this. Okay, so his ideas changed again when, as a result of their great war, Barfield managed to persuade him to accept the experience of joy as relevant to his thinking. So joy was not a deception, he now decided. Its visitations were rather the moments of clearest consciousness we had. So he, meaning Lewis, was going through this stage at 1926 and 1927, and the admission of something as irrational as joy into his ruthlessly logical thinking threw him into confusion. All my ideas are in a crumbling state at present, he wrote in his diary in May 1926. Man, I've written that exact line.
Really?
Yeah, pretty close. Yeah, he realized that he had let his rational side dominate his emotions too long, remarking in the diary, "One needn't be asking questions and giving judgments all the time." But while this realization was refreshing, he recorded in 1927 that he was frightened of what he called the danger of falling back into the most childish superstitions. And isn't that common? It's like... Yeah. I do not want to be Christian really, really badly because of what I think Christianity is.
Right.
I
exactly,
don't want it. I do not want it.
Yeah. The prejudices we have.
Right. So he still had an immense resistance to the idea of conversion to Christianity or just of Christianity. So 3 weeks after this, he stopped keeping a diary and never resumed, declaring that it was a foolish waste of time. It was perhaps,
but it also says, yeah, oh, go ahead.
It was perhaps because he was unwilling to make public. He often read his diary to Mrs. Moore and showed it to Warney. So it was a public document. The sensations
like
of supernatural he was now experiencing. So he didn't want to share it.
Yeah.
Yeah. For he had begun to feel that it was not he himself who was taking the initiative, but something outside him.
I love this part.
Yeah. As he expressed it to Owen Barfield, the spirit was showing an alarming tendency to become much more personal and is taking the offensive. One day while going up to Headington Hill on a bus, he became aware that I was holding something at bay or shutting something out. There was a choice to open the door or keep it shut. Next moment he found that he had chosen to open it. From this, which happened in 1927 or 28, it was only a matter of time before he admitted that God was God, a step that he finally took in the summer of 1929, and then he gave in and knelt and prayed. But even so, he had done no more than accept theism, a simple belief in God. He was not able to perceive the relevance of Christ's death and resurrection. And he told a friend, Jenkin, "My outlook is now definitely religious. It is not precisely Christianity, though it may turn out that way in the end. So his door's open.
I do love that thing of something is, I'm holding something at bay.
Mm-hmm.
It's like God's like, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. Nope, can't hear you.
Yep.
I just love that. And then after that is, he says, he was like, well, it doesn't have to be Christianity. I could, there's some other kind of religion, right? And every time he kept going, nope, none of them are holding up to my logic. And the thing I found interesting was he accepted the historicity of the Christian story. He was like, I'm not going to say there was no Jesus or all this stuff didn't happen just like they say. It's just it doesn't have any meaning for me. What, you know, what's the point?
Yeah, what is and the so point of that?
Right? I like, yeah, and that's a really modern question too. Whereas before, people would look at the nature of humanity and of their own selves and say, I have all these things I struggle with. These are traditionally designed or called sin. And it seems to be built into my design somehow. Therefore, I need help.
Mm-hmm.
But people were past that point. He is such a modern personality that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I like that too.
Absolutely. So this next paragraph I feel is an important one too. Would you like to read it apart from the last stage?
Yeah, which I think I was kind of summing up.
Yeah, you were. Yep, that's exactly
apart from
that.
The last stage, when he had admitted some kind of supernatural experience, Lewis had reached this position entirely through logical argument. Even his acceptance of joy as a factor had only been conceded after elaborate reasoning by Barfield. But now he began to realize that reasoning would not take him any further, and haven't we all been there?
Mm-hmm.
The acceptance of God did not lead him automatically to the acceptance of Christianity. He was becoming certain that he wanted to accept it. He examined other religions, but found none that was acceptable. Meanwhile, his present state of theism, capital T, was inadequate. On the other hand, he did not know how he could argue himself into specifically Christian beliefs. Even if he were to accept the historicity of the Christian story, and he could see no particular barrier to it, he could not understand how the death and resurrection of Christ were relevant to humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and but still here is, if I can go back to this, yeah, is the thing I please mentioned earlier, mm-hmm, still here is his love of myth with a capital M and his love of story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of why at this point he's like, I'm really kind of stuck. All these things are saying a lot of the same stuff.
Right, right. A little bit earlier, up at the top of page 40, it says that, meanwhile, he adopted a benevolent but condescending attitude to Christianity, which he said was a myth conveying as much of the truth as simple minds could grasp. So that's, so that was his thought there. Yeah.
And also, so here's the other thing, which is, it goes along with his idea of, well, I can't go back to Christianity. That's going backwards. It's childish. It's this idea that we are so advanced and that is so behind us.
Mm-hmm.
It's for kids. It's for simple people. I am superior to all that. And so this is something we all struggle with, right? How do I humble myself enough just to say what is there and what does it mean without putting all our preconceptions on it?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an argument that I've had a lot of times too with people. It's the whole idea of religion as immature science, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, religion is something that humanity passed through on the way to science. And what they're doing there's no doubt that myth was used to explain things that they were experiencing in the natural world, right?
Right.
But you have this transcendent thing, which, you know, a lot of people claim that doesn't exist, but yet we all seem to feel something that's beyond explanation,
right,
something in the transcendent. So mythology, you know, is an attempt to explain the transcendent to each other. You know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm, it's this thing that we have in common, this feeling that there's something more than here, that is more than a feeling because it is reality. That is what's coming out in the mythologies. And they're denying the poetic part of mythology, and saying, well, you know, Zeus throwing lightning down is the important part of that story. It's the explanation of lightning.
Right.
Therefore, that's what myth is just the explanation of what lightning is. It's Zeus throwing lightning bolts, right? But what they're denying is the poetic truth of what the myth is conveying. In my opinion, that's a denial of that aspect of mythology, which is what, you know, Tolkien and Dyson get into, which is, these are all part truth, but we're about to get into that.
Well, and I would say it's interesting because it also denies the fact that a person may have a personal experience during that natural phenomenon that God may use to get their attention. And you're taking the personal out of it at that point. You're just saying, well, they all knew lightning, and so they just made this up. Well, maybe. But the other thing is, I just had this discussion with my mother a couple days ago where she likes to kind of throw out these little challenges now and then. And I can't remember why we wound up talking about Moses and the burning bush, because she started it. That's not the kind of thing I bring up in general conversation. But she was saying, you know, don't you think maybe bushes could have just burned anyway? They're all dry and the sun's hot and this and that. And I said, well, yeah, I actually had read something that said that was not an uncommon phenomenon. But the thing that was uncommon is this bush was not being consumed by the flame. It just kept burning. That's what made him go look at it. And that's what the scripture says. Mm. And that's where you go, this is God using this thing. Are you going to pay attention? It's natural, but it's also unnatural, supernatural at the same time. And sometimes, as you say, it's, or even Tolkien and everybody would say, it's also the poetic. It's also what we feel. But a lot of times God knows us so well, he is personally getting our attention in a way that other people from the outside can't understand, and he'll do that for every single one of us.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry.
No, that's perfect. Yeah, okay. Very well done. So here we go. On Saturday, the 19th of September, 1931, the Lewis invited two friends to dine with him. So it wasn't a typical Inklings meeting, like I said before.
Right.
Yeah. One was Tolkien and the other one was Hugo Dyson. So they come over for dinner. So after they dined, Lewis took his guests on a walk through the Magdalen grounds. They strolled along Addison's Walk, and here they began to discuss metaphor and myth. Lewis had never underestimated the power of myth, far from it. For one of his earliest loves had been Norse myth, and we talked about that earlier, of the dying god Balder. Now, Barfield had shown him the crucial role that mythology had played in the history of language and literature, but he still did not believe in the myths that delighted him. Beautiful and moving as such stories might be, they were, he said, ultimately untrue. As he expressed it to Tolkien, myths are lies and therefore worthless, even though breathed through silver. And that's interesting for a professor to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know? No, said Tolkien, they are not lies.
I just love that.
Yep. Just then, Lewis afterwards recalled, there was a rush of wind which came so suddenly on the still warm evening and sent so many leaves pattering down that we thought it was raining. We held our breath. When Tolkien... go ahead.
I was just like, and talk about using a natural phenomenon to get your attention, because it was totally still, mm-hmm. that huge, forceful rush of wind, and that is just like the Holy Spirit coming over the apostles at Pentecost,
mm-hmm.
described as a mighty wind.
Yeah, yeah. When Tolkien resumed, he took his argument from the very thing that they were watching. You look at trees, he said, and call them trees, and probably you do not think twice about the word. You call a star, and think nothing more of it. But you must remember that these words, tree, star, were in their original forms, names given to these objects by people with very different views from yours. To you, a tree is simply a vegetable organism, and a star is simply a ball of inanimate matter moving along a mathematical course. But to the first men, to talk of trees and stars, saw things very differently. To them, the world was alive with mythological beings. They saw stars as living silver, bursting into flame in answer to the eternal music. They saw the sky as a jeweled tent, and the earth as the womb whence all living things have come. To them, the whole of creation was myth-woven and elf-patterned. This was not a new notion for Lewis, but Tolkien was, in his own manner, expressing what Barfield had said in poetic diction. Nor, said Lewis, did it effectively answer his point that myths are lies. But, replied Tolkien, a man is not ultimately a liar. He may pervert his thoughts into lies, but he comes from God, and it is from God that he draws his ultimate ideals. Lewis agreed. He had indeed accepted something like this notion for many years. Therefore, Tolkien continued, not merely the abstract thoughts of man, but also his imaginative inventions must originate with God, and must in consequence reflect something of eternal truth. In making myth, in practicing mythopoeia, and peopling the world with elves and dragons and goblins, a storyteller, or sub-creator, as Tolkien liked to call such a person, is actually fulfilling God's purpose and reflecting a splintered fragment of the true light. Pagan myths are therefore never just lies. There is always something of truth in them.
That's so powerful.
It really is, yeah. And then they talked on until Lewis was convinced by the force of Tolkien's argument. But he had another question to put to his friends. And as it was late, they decided to go indoors to Lewis's rooms on staircase 3 of new buildings. There he recorded, "We Continued on Christianity." But yes, so see, should I read this whole thing?
Well, I was going
to go down to.
I would skip down to where it says.
Yeah, please.
What was the point of it all?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so basically, Lewis, as we kind of discussed, had said, you know, he'd looked at the Gospels and everything. He's like, it happened, but, you know, what's the point? Who cares? It was 2,000 years ago. And he says, and there's all these weird phrases, propitiation, sacrifice, the blood of the lamb. He had ridiculed them because they seemed not only silly and shocking, but meaningless. What was the point of it all? How could the death and resurrection of Christ have saved the world? And isn't that a modern question?
Yes.
We all wonder that. Mm-hmm. So Tolkien answered him immediately. Indeed, he said, the solution was actually a development of what he had been saying earlier. Had he not shown how pagan myths were, in fact, God expressing himself through the minds of poets and using the images of their mythopoeia to express fragments of his eternal truth? Well, then, Christianity, he said, is exactly the same thing, with the enormous difference that the poet who invented it was God himself, and the images he used were real men and actual history. And I just have to stop for a second because, to me, that was powerful again, thinking of God writing with history and people and us cooperating with him.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the book. Do you mean, asked Lewis, that the death and resurrection of Christ is the old dying God story all over again? Yes, Tolkien answered, except that here is a real dying God with a precise location in history and definite historical consequences. The old myth has become a fact, but it still retains the character of a myth. So that in asking what it meant, Lewis was really being rather absurd. Did he ask what the story of Baldur or Adonis or any of the other dying gods in pagan myth meant? No, of course not. He enjoyed these stories, tasted them, and got something from them that he could not get from abstract argument. Could he not transfer that attitude, that appreciation of story, to the life and death of Christ? Could he not treat it as a story, be fully aware that he could draw nourishment from it, which he could never find in a list of abstract truths? Could he not realize that it is a myth and make himself receptive to it? For Tolkien said, if God is mythopoeic, man must become mythopathic.
Mm-hmm. Wow. In the beginning was the word.
Yeah, right? And we're wired for story. Wired for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I think I've mentioned before that book called The Storytelling Animal.
Yeah.
And, you know, that whole, it was so eye-opening to me when he was saying, think about it. Somebody says, how was your day? And you tell the story of your day.
Mm.
You emphasize certain things, de-emphasize others. You're telling, you know, I had this encounter with this person and here's the point. Here's why I cared.
Mm.
This is everything we do. Going to the store is a story.
Yeah.
And I went, oh my gosh, he's right.
Heck yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've got to read that book. I wrote it down. The Storytelling Animal.
Yeah. And as I said, it's really the first part is the really good bit. It's probably would have been better as a long essay or something.
Uh-huh.
And if you care about the proofs, those are the last half. But the first part at least is really amazing. So.
Cool.
But this whole thing, you know, this is the essence. I remember reading about this conversation, not in this depth before. And so I found the way it was written to be so wonderful that last night I spent a considerable time copying most of it into my quote journal.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Humphrey Carpenter did a fantastic job with that.
Oh, yeah.
Well done. Yep.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And it was cool right after that. Just, you know, it was now 3 a.m. and Tolkien had to go home. I really just love that.
Yeah.
So we were talking till 3 in the morning.
Oh, look at the time.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
You do have a wife and a family.
I love it. I love that. Yeah. And then 12 days later, Lewis wrote to Arthur Greaves, I have just passed on from believing in God to definitely believing in Christ. In Christianity, I will try to explain this another time. Spent the rest of his life doing that. My long night talk with Dyson and Tolkien had a great deal to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really great.
Yeah, because he and Dyson went on talking for another hour. So there was more going on. Just Dyson wasn't busy writing letters or putting it in a diary, so we don't know what it was.
Right. Yeah. So, wow. So, yeah, that's really great. I just love, you know, we're at like 52 minutes already. But I just love this book for that. I mean, that chapter was what I remembered out of this book.
Yeah.
And why I wanted to read it again. But I also, the second reason for wanting to read it again was just the description of, you know, how their group operated and how they read to each other stuff from their own works. And, you know, so it wasn't only philosophy they were talking about, but they were always talking about big ideas and things. But to have a group of people, you know, they're sharing their writing and have those people, those are the folks that wrote The Lord of the Rings, right? And those are the folks that wrote
The Narnia
Chronicles series and all of the nonfiction that C.S. Lewis wrote and did on the radio and all that stuff. And then Charles Williams. Charles Williams was interesting, although I have never read anything by him, and I don't know that I'm moved to do so from this book.
No, I tried two or three of his books once I discovered he was one of the Inklings, and I could never get very far in them. And once I read more about him, I understood why. He wasn't writing from a viewpoint I could understand very well.
I see.
And so I wasn't really connecting with it very well. And I would say it's funny because all of them were writing really different stuff. Like Warney, Jack Lewis's brother, C.S. Lewis's brother, was really interested in French history of a certain period.
Mm-hmm.
So he wound up writing all these books about it because people really encouraged him to write whatever he wanted. And they would listen to him read some of it. And Tolkien, though he wasn't interested in that, read all the books and was like, wow, these are really great.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the chapters I really enjoyed was there's one called, I think it's called Thursday Evening or something like that. And it just described what a typical conversation would have been like amongst them. And it's reconstructed from Tolkien's letters and a few notes that various people had in letters or things to each other. And the author had to fill in a little bit some things from other sources.
That captured me too. I had mixed feelings about that. I totally enjoyed reading it, and I thought it was great. But I'm like, is this fiction? You know, it was. You know, he explained. You know, I got some stuff from their diaries, and I got this stuff, and I've tried to recreate a typical evening. And,
but I thought it was probably representative enough because none of them were recording it or might remember everything, but.
Mm-hmm.
They went from talking about philosophy to talking about what they were reading to talking about the war and evolution. And I mean, they were just talking, you know, what does Tolkien's story mean? And Lewis is like, does it have to mean something?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not crazy about elves and goblins. So it's just everything.
Right.
And yeah, what an intellectually stimulating group.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure. Yeah.
And comfortable enough to talk about things without just ripping each other apart. And we're not very well able to do that, even among close groups of friends these days.
Yeah, I agree with that too. Yeah, I agree with that very much. But yeah, it's like, yeah. And to do that regularly, I mean, how nourishing that would be.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing you were saying about, you know, different times in your life when you have different groups of people like that, and you kind of feel like you'd like to hang on to it.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens, as you see in this book, as time goes by, eventually it falls apart. And, you know, in this case, Lewis was what held it together, but it started falling apart before that for various reasons that no one could put their finger on.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You just have to treasure those moments when they happen. Not that anything's happening to the podcast. Don't get me wrong. Doing this long as we can.
Absolutely. Yeah. But things happen, right? You know, people's circumstances change and their interests change and,
and
you
friendships
know, people get
change.
Tired of each other, right? It's like, you know, I've heard everything you have to say. It's time for me to go find someone else, which is a really rough way to put that. But it's just, but it's really circumstances, right? You know, and history, you know, history.
Right.
This is why marriage is so hard, right?
Yes.
You know?
You have a commitment that's beyond friendship in that point.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah. It's why it's continually got to be focused on and worked on, because it's more important than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then often these kinds of close friendships get in conflict, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're leaving every Thursday and every Tuesday or whatever, but, you know, there are family obligations and things like that, you know, that, that you know. So I guess I'm saying the natural tendency is for things like this to fall apart.
Yes.
Right. So, which is what you said as well. You know, and I liked, you know, in the book, there was a lot of these really cool details, like this one. The writing of stories in prose came almost incredibly easy to Lewis. It's such fun after sweating over verse, he said, like freewheeling. He worked fast, managed to write almost everything in one draft, and never made more than minimal revisions.
Wow.
In contrast, this was in marked contrast to Tolkien, who, though he wrote fast, took endless pains over revision and regarded it as a continuing process that was not necessarily complete when the book was published. The two men were also very different in their attitudes to the manuscripts of their work. Tolkien invariably kept all his drafts and his notes, as we can see with what's being published now still. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis is just as invariably tore up his as soon as the book reached print.
Yeah.
He also tore up other people's. Tolkien recalled he was indeed accustomed at intervals to throw away papers and books. And at such times he destroyed those that belonged to other people. He lost not only official documents sent to him by me, but sole manuscripts of at least two stories.
Kind of hate him for that.
Come on, Lewis. Okay. What are you doing?
Yeah, no. Think of us. But I do understand. I'm also an inveterate tosser-outer, and then I'm usually sorry later. So
I often am, too. Yeah.
My husband's more like Tolkien. He's hanging on to everything. So between us, we're keeping a house.
Between us, you've got a stack of important things.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The other thing I liked about this, since it was following Lewis's progression in a lot of ways, is it was saying now at this point in his life, he was asked to give these talks, and then he was turned them into a book, which became Mere Christianity, or, you know, he became a Christian, then he wrote Pilgrim's Regress or whatever it was. Anyway, and so it would talk about the books he wrote, and I felt the author was a bit tough on some of his works, frankly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a bit opinionated, and I didn't always agree with his opinion, which was fine. I was just kind of surprised sometimes when he goes, well, this wasn't the greatest. I'm like, what? No, I like that book. So,
yeah.
But it also gave you this insight that one of the things I wanted to read. since we're on a reading kick. This is well worth reading, is the first thing I ever read by C.S. Lewis, because this is something that anyone can read, Christian or not, and appreciate, which is the Screwtape Letters. And I feel it was probably his most famous thing in America anyway. Before everybody really got going on everything else he wrote. And it's, you know, basically a series of letters from the old experienced demon to his nephew, and who is in the process of learning how to tempt and corrupt a human soul. And so in the process of the letters, it's all, of course, reverse psychology. Everything that he's advising that, you know, oh, you can get him this way and you get him that way. It's pretty easy. And when, so we're supposed to look at that and go, oh, no, I do those things. That's totally wrong. Or they'll talk about the enemy in capital E, and it's, of course, God. And so this is something that, you know, oh, God designed it like this. So it's very cleverly written. It's very engaging. And it's surprisingly, I found that it creeped a few of my friends out and they wouldn't read it. I was like, it is fiction, you know, it is. But what surprised me was that how Lewis felt while he was writing it. And I don't know if this is something that stood out to you, but it says, if Screwtape was written with complete sincerity, the actual task of writing it proved to be remarkably unpleasant. Though I had never written anything more easily, Lewis recalled, I never wrote with less enjoyment. Though it was easy to twist one's mind into the diabolical attitude, it was not fun, or not for long. The strain produced a sort of spiritual cramp. The world into which I had to project myself while I spoke through Screwtape was all dust, grit, thirst, and itch. It almost smothered me before I was done. So.
Yeah, that's now, neat.
Yeah, and this is, they're talking in some ways about, they then talk about Charles Lewis, who wrote a lot about black magic, but they're saying, or Charles Williams, I'm sorry, who wrote a lot about black magic, but then they're saying he didn't really believe in the devil.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Absolutely believed in the devil.
Right, and so did Tolkien. I've got a paragraph marked here. Tolkien did not specify what it was in Williams's work that he found distasteful, but once in his old age, he referred to Williams as a witch doctor. Certainly, he was aware, perhaps more than Lewis was, of the importance of black magic and devilry in some of Williams's books. Tolkien himself had a profound belief in the devil and all his works, and he did not think that such things should be bandied about in popular novels.
Yeah, which I know that Lewis dedicated Screwtape to Tolkien, and Tolkien did not appreciate it for that very reason. He's like, you shouldn't have written about this.
Yeah.
But it is valuable to read, and I think I thought that insight was really valuable too, is in order to change your mind, to have that diabolical mindset, it does something to your soul. You know, it didn't corrupt him, but he could feel it.
Yep, absolutely.
So, yeah, so the book has insights like that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well worth reading.
Right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say about it?
No, I was just thinking, though, it's a kind of a funny book because you can pick it up intending to read Lewis's life, and it's a good telling of his life. But that's not all it is. It's kind of like the Inklings, where it's something more complex and less easy to grasp, this book is. Yeah. So in that way, I guess it's a good representation of what the group was.
Right, right. You know? That's a good point. Yeah, I like that point. And I agree with that. Yeah. I feel like I need to read Carpenter's book on Tolkien to complete it.
I said, I feel the same way, and I'm kind of cursing the fact that you made me read this, because I'm like, I did not want to read that book. No. I mean, not that I actively didn't want to read it, but I'm like, it's long. I don't care about the details, but now I kind of do.
Maybe it's good on audio. I wonder if we can find an audio version.
Because
then, you just kind of have it on.
Just kind of listen to like a podcast sort of a stages.
And this book is not that long either. It's a pleasant length, 250 pages. I guess that's my own little thing. It's probably because I don't read fast enough, but it's like when I'm confronted with, 800 to 1,000 page biographies of people, I rarely read those. But if I, a 200 pager, I'd read that. And then if I'm so inclined after that, I could go after something bigger,
Yeah.
But I would love to see 200 to 300 page biographies of people.
I agree. The other ones are way too long, and this was mm-hmm. just perfect. Well, I guess the last thing to me was it's always disappointing when you find out that Lewis and Tolkien were friends. Well, that's not disappointing. It's delightful. Mm-hmm. And then you find out they weren't friends later. And mm-hmm. it kind of hurts a little, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the at very end of the book was so wonderful. It says, not long after Lewis's death, Tolkien began a letter to one of his children. I am sorry that I have not answered your letter sooner, but Jack Lewis's death on the 22nd has preoccupied me. It is also involving me in some correspondence, as many people still regard me as one of his intimates. Alas, that ceased to be some 10 years ago. We were separated first by the sudden apparition of Charles Williams, and then by his marriage. But we owed each a great debt to the other, and that tie, with the deep affection that it begot, remained. He was a great man of whom the cold-blooded official obituaries have only scraped the surface.
Hmm.
So there's that still that personal love.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Which I really love. And then, this is a story I came across, and I didn't write the source down, but I just love it so much. So this gives us a little hint about after, and says C.S. Lewis's friend J.B. Phillips was in a deep depression that threatened his faith and his life. So basically, he had become a recluse and shut himself into his room and was thinking about suicide, and it was really grim. And it says, suddenly, a ruddy and glowing Lewis stood before him, entering his room through closed doors, a, quote, healthy Lewis, hearty and glowing, as Phillips later wrote. Lewis said one sentence, J.B., it's not as hard as you think. The effect of that sentence was Phillips snapped instantly out of his depression, leaving him full of joy and love of God. After Lewis spoke, he disappeared. Phillips left his room to find that Lewis had died moments before the appearance, miles away.
Hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's, yeah. And that last little story isn't really necessary, I guess, but I just sometimes if things are getting to me and you're thinking about what happens later, and it's that it's not as hard as you think. And that's kind of what Lewis did for us. With Mere Christianity, the Screwtape Letters, all the things he talked about were the things of everyday life. You know,
yeah,
it's hard, yeah. But it's not as hard as you think. Just kind of go ahead and do it. It's mm-hmm. fine.
Yeah, I just love that image. I'm just thinking about it.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that this happens, and the person who needs him most is the one who he goes and talks to, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
God knows where he's needed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yep. He died on the same day that Kennedy was assassinated, I believe. And therefore,
oh, really?
People didn't pay attention to it nearly the way they would have otherwise.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Stuff was happening. My
well,
gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And he wasn't as he was famous, but, you know,
yeah,
not that famous.
For sure. Well,
I'm
great.
Glad we
read
this.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks. That was a great way to end this. Yeah, it's got me contemplative.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, thank you for reading it. And yeah, it was fun. Worthwhile read.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. So great.
Even if you think you know all about them, and I thought I knew a fair amount about Lewis's life, and I did, but the thing I liked also is that Carpenter kind of condenses and skips over a lot of the very early life. He just tells you what you need to know in terms of context and then gets into the life, his life as a, oh, I guess an inkling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Good. Well, great. Okay. So what have we got next? Hamlet.
Light stuff.
Hamlet.
Yeah.
Hamlet. Yeah. We have never done, we have never done a Shakespeare on this,
on
Good Story. And I wanted to do one, and I thought about it a long time, and I thought Hamlet's one of the most accessible ones. So I thought, let's do that. And then I picked the Mel Gibson version of it. I rewatched it recently to make sure I still liked it, because that was the first one I saw.
Oh,
so I would like to do that. And I've seen several versions since. But I thought it was good. I thought it did a really good job.
Okay.
So, yeah. So Hamlet it is. And it's good. It's that's mid-September, and it's feeding into October, and it's a ghost story.
Yeah.
So why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And looking at the deeper things of life.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And absolutely.
Yeah. No, I don't watch much Shakespeare or like almost any Shakespeare unless Joss Whedon directs one, which he's only done one.
He's only done one.
That's pretty much it for me. So this is good because it makes me kind of do it. I always want to, but you know, wanting to and making yourself do it are two different things.
Yeah.
So this is perfect.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I always watch Shakespeare, by the way, with the subtitles on. It helps me a lot. Yeah.
Good idea. Yeah. Because my husband really hates Shakespeare.
Yeah, I used to follow along with a script in the book, you know. Mm-hmm. But in the movies, they edit the script a little bit. You know, sometimes they're just like, oh, we'll take this out and do this, you know, whatever works for them. Mm-hmm. And I discovered, I'll just turn on the subtitles and that takes care of that.
Yeah, because it takes about 10 minutes to get my brain into the rhythm of the language and then I'm okay. But at first, I'm always struggling a little.
Yeah.
So well, perfect.
Good. Yeah. So that's our plan. Anyway. Yep. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for listening, everybody. And
we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah. And C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, hopefully you're looking down on us and
praying for us.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well, take care, everybody.
Absolutely. Yes.
Bye-bye. Talk to you in a couple weeks. Bye-bye.